from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, private equity has become a hot topic in the presidential election, with both President Obama and Mitt Romney hurling barbs over the issue. But what's the truth beneath the political rhetoric? We'll discuss advantages and pitfalls to a business that makes some people very wealthy. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Private equity firms bring together private capital to companies struggling or to those with growth potential, and the private equity industry presently holds $3 trillion in global assets. In the United States, there are some 2,600 private equity firms invested in over 15,000 companies. Mitt Romney, the presumed Republican presidential candidate, co-founded Bain Capital and was CEO of that private equity firm. As a result, the spotlight on Bain and private equity firms and the ways in which they conduct business has already begun in the presidential campaign. Will Governor Romney's record help or hurt his presidential campaign? And are such companies good for the economy or only for the company's shareholders? We want to turn our attention in this Forum Hour to Bain Capital and to the private equity industry. And joining us first is Sebastian Malaby. He's director of the Maurice R. Greenberg Center for Geoeconomic Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations. And he published an opinion piece called Mr. Obama Stop the Attack on Private Equity, which appeared in the Financial Times on May 24th. And Sebastian Malaby, good to have you with us on Forum. Good morning.
Good to be with you.
Well, your article seems to feel that attacks on private equity, and particularly on Bain Capital and Mitt Romney, are ill-advised. Talk about Bain being a blood bank or a vampire or rogue capitalism really don't quite, well, give the narrative of what private equity firms do.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I think that in the 19th century, we came up with this innovation, the public corporation, with shares dispersed broadly to lots of different stockholders, and that was a smart way to raise capital then. And it survived the test of time better than most 19th century innovations. But time might arrive when, in fact, other ways of raising capital, partly through these vehicles you describe, private equity funds, may in fact maximize the value of the company and encourage innovation and all that good stuff we want better or as well as public companies. And so, you know, before anyone attacks private equity, they need to be clear that the alternative in terms of bigger companies anyway would be public equity. Do they really think the stock market always prices companies perfectly? I suspect some people who attack private equity would also could be found elsewhere attacking so-called casino capitalism. So I just think we need to be a bit thoughtful before we attack private equity.
Well, you say in your piece in the Financial Times that public equity is in decline because of the relationship between owners and managers becoming so fraught.
That's right. So, I mean, the classic problem in public companies is that the owners, who are the shareholders, don't have direct control over what the company does because the managers control that. And so there's a variety of mechanisms to try to get the managers to behave in a fashion that actually is aligned with the interests of the shareholders. And so you have a board sitting in between the two that's supposed to make sure the managers do what's expected. You have various mechanisms like paying managers in stock or stock options to align their incentives. But essentially, these principal agent problems have not been solved. Stock options can create perverse incentives. And so, the public company has some advantages, but it also has some disadvantages. And private equity, when you look at the sort of effects, you know, how well private equity-owned companies do, they appear to be, in terms of the academic research, they appear to not destroy jobs more than publicly owned company. They appear to innovate at least as much.
I think, forgive me, the research shows about 1% difference in terms of jobs loss.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And so I view that as, and I think the paper that we're talking about says that that's pretty much a wash.
But there is a sense that because 60% come from pension funds, endowments, and foundations in terms of the revenue in private equity firms. In fact, there was a viral thing that went out over the internet just over the weekend that compared private equity firms to the Sopranos, you know, stripping and flipping and all that sort of thing. And as I said, the rhetoric is heated up because of the presidential campaign with talk about vampires and the like. But you point out in your article that if the president and his advisors decide to go to war, they're going to be going up against companies like Toys R Us or Burger King, and what could be more American than those?
Yeah, and if the stripping and flipping rhetoric were true, we ought to be concerned about private equity if they really were destroying a lot of jobs. But as we've just discussed, the evidence doesn't support that. So I don't find that persuasive. You can also measure, which types of companies increase productivity more, and the answer seems to be that private equity does pretty well against the alternative. So, again, I'm not, saying that all companies should be owned by private equity funds at all. I'm just saying it seems to be a form of ownership which delivers pretty good results, according to the evidence that we've got. And demonizing Burger King or Toys R Us, as you say, because they happen to be in one type of ownership structure, just seems to be a useless debate to have. There are other more important things we could discuss in the economy. We could discuss inequality. We could discuss high unemployment. We could discuss what we're going to do about our fiscal mess. There's plenty of serious debates to have. We don't need to have this debate.
Talking with Sebastian Mallaby, who is the author of a piece that appeared in the May 24th edition of the Financial Times called Mr. Obama Stop the Attack on Private Equity. Shouldn't they be more regulated?
Well, to what end? I mean, if you tell me, look, let's go back. Regulators have one of the toughest jobs in the modern economy. It is extraordinarily difficult to regulate finance, and the proof of that is that different types of regulatory organization, whether in the United States, whether you look at the Fed or the SEC or the Commodities Futures Trading Commission or any of these different entities, the FDIC, they all made mistakes and trouble happened on their watch. If you extend the analysis to different forms of regulatory body in Europe, London created a freestanding kind of super regulator called the FSA. That also messed up. So regulation is very difficult, but you've got to do it. And therefore, what we need to do is to be discriminating and intelligent about the tasks that we set for the regulators to do, because they can't do everything. They are hard-pressed enough to even do what they are being asked to do. So to extend their mission to regulate further something which appears to be doing a perfectly good job is just a mistake, because you will stretch these people's energy even thinner, and they will do a less good job at regulating what they ought to regulate, which is too big to fail financial institutions, which are toxic for our system.
Again, Sebastian Mallaby with us by phone. His article, Mr. Obama Stopped the Attack on Private Equity, appears in the Financial Times of May 24th. Before we say goodbye to you, Sebastian Mallaby, what about the debacle of J.P. Morgan? Is it linked more to public equity than private equity?
Well, the debacle at J.P. Morgan is very serious indeed, but it's got absolutely zero to do with private equity. I mean, that's a classic case of a big publicly owned bank trading on its own book and making a complete mistake and losing a lot of money. Now, luckily, J.P. Morgan has a big enough balance sheet that it's not going to need a taxpayer bailout or anything like that. So it can swallow the problem by itself, thank goodness. But this mistake that J.P. Morgan made of losing $2 billion on this crazy trade in London reminds us that there are serious risks that regulators are missing in the big banks that they ought to be focusing on. And extending the regulators' focus or the focus of our political debate onto private equity, which is essentially smallish anyway, relative to J.P. Morgan, private partnerships, which take risks on their own account for their partners, and if they lose money, it's their problem. I just think that private equity can be left to essentially do the job it's doing. It seems to be a pretty respectable job. And I'm much more worried about JP Morgan, and I'm much more worried about the need to better regulate these too-big-to-fail banks.
Again, Sebastian Mallaby, with us by phone, director of the Maurice R. Greenberg Center for Geoeconomic Studies on the Council of Foreign Relations. And his opinion piece was in the Financial Times on May 24th. Mr. Obama stopped the attack on private equity in the Financial Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
And it's also a pleasure to have Colin Bladen, who's here with us in studio, director of the Center for Private Equity and Entrepreneurship at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. And good morning.
Good morning.
And we have Eileen Applebaum with us by phone. She's in Philadelphia. She's a senior economist with the Center for Economic Policy and Research and former professor and director of Rutgers University's Center for Women and Work. Welcome, Professor Applebaum.
Thank you.
And Colin Bladen, let me begin with you getting some response to what you just heard from Sebastian Mallaby. The thing that drives many of us to greater concern about private equity is the leveraging that goes on and the tax loopholes. We haven't even discussed those yet.
No, we haven't. And I think, though, where the conversation about any of those policy questions needs to begin is, what is the purpose we want private equity to serve in our economy? And how should we deal with it? And the flip side of that is then, what do we want, as Mr. Mallaby said, our government and our regulators to be doing? And when you muddle it up in a presidential campaign, it gets perhaps not the clearest explanation of what we're all up to here. And the leverage that you mention is certainly part of it, and that is part of the thing, something that public policy deals with and regulation deals with.
Doesn't seem very fair to most taxpayers that you can deduct tax and have the lower rate of 15% on capital gain when ordinary income is up to 35%. In other words, these big investors in hedge funds and the like with private pension funds make some pretty big killings and also don't have to pay the normal taxes the rest of us have to pay.
Of course, so do the rest of us who buy houses and take out mortgages. So there are many places within the economy the tax policy lets interest rates be deductible and treats the gains on investments as capital gains rather than income. And many of us benefit from that, not just financial investors.
But forgive me if I'm mistaken. Wasn't the original purpose of private equity to encourage borrowing to build new factories, not necessarily to finance leveraged buyouts?
No, I don't think it was. Basically, the guys who went into and developed private equity saw the opportunity to raise private money to invest it in companies that they would transform and make more valuable. And if they did that successfully, they succeeded for their investors, who in this day and age are mostly large public employee pension funds. And when they do that, they make money for themselves as investors as well.
And what about regulation? I mean, particularly regulation that will create safety nets for those who are being fired or relieved of their jobs, even though, as I said, research seems to show maybe about a 1%, almost a wash in terms of jobs from that sector to the others.
Well, I think what you raise are really two different questions. Regulation basically tries to keep a level playing field, try and prevent train wrecks, try and prevent inappropriate self-dealing, safety nets. All of those other things that you mentioned are things that our public policy, our public benefits provide. It's the role that government provides more broadly. It's not something that regulation provides.
Colin Bladen here with us in studio directs the Center for Private Equity and Entrepreneurship at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth and doesn't necessarily reflect anything about his politics or partisanship, but he actually taught finance to Mitt Romney a few years ago. Eileen Applebaum is with us from Philadelphia. She's senior economist with the Center for Economic Policy and Research, former professor and director of Rutgers University's Center for Women and Work. Professor Applebaum, as far as jobs, you don't see it as necessarily a wash. You see it, private equity as being bad for jobs.
Well, you know, there are three issues where we have to think about what private equity does. One is jobs, one is bankruptcy, and the other is returns to investors. And all of the research almost all of it has been done by researchers who are supportive of private equity, favorable to it, and so on. And so I'd like to start by commenting on the jobs, and then we can get back to the other two points later, if you like. The exact study on jobs that concludes that the difference in job creation is just 1% less, or a little less than 1% less in private equity than in publicly traded companies, that conclusion is very misleading. That is like reading the headline. That's the conclusion that the authors want you to draw. But they are, in fact, good academics and good researchers.
These were done at Harvard University of Chicago, I should mention, yes?
That's correct, yeah. And by top researchers. So in the body of the research, they actually do report their findings. And what they find are a couple of things. First, the idea that private equity buys distressed companies and turns them around, wins some, loses some, just doesn't hold up. Employment grows faster in the private equity. The target companies that the private equity companies take over grows faster in those companies than in other companies prior to acquisition. But there is, and this is a direct quote from them, a clear pattern of slower growth at targets post the buyout. And over a five-year period, the differential is 6.4% of employment. The slower employment growth, they tell us, at private equity targets reflects a greater pace of job destruction. That's a direct quote. And in retail, which is the place where you can do the asset stripping, in retail, employment falls by nearly 12% in the private equity targets. The way that they get to the little, you know, that less than 1% is that they not only look at what happens when private equity acquires a company and owns it and runs it, and even adding in greenfield plants, you still have a big differential. But what they often do is if they buy, we think of them as buying publicly traded companies, but that's not the only thing they do. A big part of what they do is they buy companies that were started by a family. It's a family-owned company. It never got big enough to go public, and now the founder wants to retire, sells to a private equity company. And what private equity will do in that case, in order to have a bigger company that they can sell or take public, is they will acquire other companies and acquire those companies' workers. They did not create those jobs. There's no evidence that private equity creates jobs relative to other companies. Rather, it falls way behind, or in the case of retail, actually destroys jobs. But if you count the acquisitions, we buy another company so we can take the larger company public, they did not create those jobs. They acquired them, and that's how they get to the less than 1%. In retail, what they do, and you will be very familiar with this, your listeners in Northern California, because you know the Mervin story. What they did there is they acquired Mervin's. They split the company immediately into a property. Well, Mervin's owned most of the stores, most of the actual physical outlets. They owned not only the business, but the stores in which they were located. And they split it into two companies immediately, an operating company and a property company. And they held the real estate assets for about a year so they could get the tax benefit. And then they sold the real estate off. And once they had done that, they had already made their profit, and it didn't matter to them at all whether the operating company, the Mervin's, succeeded or not. And I can go into more detail.
Yeah, well, that, in fact,
but that's enough, right? They got rid of those assets. Yeah. And Mervin's, when it went under, when it went bankrupt, its liabilities exceeded its assets by less than the increase in the rent they had to pay now that they had to rent those stores.
So it's bad, especially for retail. And there was that big lawsuit with Levi's. I just want to get to the heart of your opposition, though, because most of the money is made through leverage buyouts and most of the profits go to, well, people like Mitt Romney, I suppose you could say. So is it fair to characterize private equity the way it's been characterized, as a predatory system essentially designed to pump up Wall Street profits?
Right. So I think it's more complicated than that. I definitely think that there is a need for the kind of input that we get from private equity, that they have the possibility when they want to do it to provide access to superior management. They can provide access, greater access to finance, and we certainly have examples. For example, hospitals are coming under a lot of pressure to modernize and to keep up with healthcare reform, with the Obama healthcare reform. Many of them lack the resources to do this. Private equity has come in and bought up a lot of hospitals in America, and they are presumably making the necessary investments. So that would be an example. Or we do have a thin sliver of distressed investing. About 2% of investing by private equity is in distressed companies. And one of our big success stories is the U.S. steel industry, which in 2000 was in danger of disappearing completely. It was just crumbling. And Wilbur Ross came in, that private equity company, and bought up a number of them. And nearly every mill that Wilbur Ross company bought up is today operating. They've been consolidated. They're now part of ArcelorMittal. And we have a very powerful domestic steel industry based in this one big consolidated company.
Well, you're giving us a mixed picture. How much regulation do we need then?
So my view is that we want, I didn't talk about bankruptcy, but the highly leveraged companies go bankrupt at a much higher rate than other companies. And in the recession, about a quarter of highly leveraged companies have gone bankrupt. So I think that what we really want to do is we want to encourage the good parts, discourage the bad parts. And one of the important things we could do would be to limit the deductibility of interest. Why do we favor debt over equity when it comes to investing in companies? And this is in general. I mean, this would apply to all companies. But, of course, as you pointed out, it's the leveraged buyouts that make the greatest use of debt. And therefore, so debt, when you have debt, if you win, it really, you know, maximizes or expands your returns. But if you lose, the company goes bankrupt. And the investment of the private equity firm is minimal. They put up 1 to 2% of the fund, and then the fund puts up maybe 25% of the down payment. And the rest of it is debt. The people who lose are all of the lenders who have lent that other 75%. And we have some spectacular examples. Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Oh, I'm also interested, though, in your response to that. You've already said that there are problems with the studies out of University of Chicago and Harvard on jobs, but there was another study about the high level of debt between 1997 and 2010, and said that private equity firms didn't default at higher levels and similarly burdened companies and issued new debt to pay dividends to buyout owners didn't put them at greater financial risk.
Well, the study that I saw showed that up to the point of 2007, I saw a study per Stromberg up to 2007, they were going, you know, over a long period of time, over about a 20-year period, they went bankrupt at about twice the rate of ordinary company of other, you know, publicly owned companies. But that was about 7% of companies went bankrupt while in private equity hands. That's bad, but it's not horrible. But in this last financial crisis, looking from 2007 to 2010, looking at all highly leveraged companies, not just those in private equity hands, about a quarter of them went bankrupt. And of course, highly leveraged companies are much more common in private equity than they are in publicly traded companies, because publicly traded companies are subject to public scrutiny. But I would want to limit the deductibility of interest in general. I don't view that as aimed for, you know, only at private equity. And the other thing is I would, of course, get rid of the carried interest, that they can do that at 15%. They put up 1 to 2%. They take 20% of the profit.
We're going to have to hold it there because we are coming up on a break. Eileen Applebaum with us by phone, and we have Colin Bladen with us as well, director of the Center for Private Equity and Entrepreneurship at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Professor Applebaum, former professor and director of Rutgers Center for Women and Work, and senior economist with the Center for Economic Policy and Research. You can join this discussion. In fact, we invite you to do that. You may have questions or comments, and we welcome your involvement in the conversation. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Private equity has become a hot topic in the presidential election, both President Obama and Mitt Romney hurling barbs over the issue, and we're trying to look at the truth beneath the political rhetoric and what private equity firms are all about and how they conduct their business, talking about the advantages and pitfalls to a business that makes some people very wealthy. We spoke earlier with Sebastian Malaby, who is director of the Maurice R. Greenberg Center for Geoeconomic Studies of Inconsul and Foreign Relations, and who published an opinion piece in the May 24th Financial Times called Mr. Obama Stop the Attack on Private Equity. Colin Bladen is with us in studio. He directs the Center for Private Equity and Entrepreneurship at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. And Eileen Applebaum is with us by phone from Philadelphia. She is senior economist with the Center for Economic Policy and Research and former professor and director of Rutgers University's Center for Women and Work. You are, of course, welcome to join the program. Grab a phone line when it becomes available, toll free at 866-733-6786, or email us, forum at kqed.org, particularly if you want to register your thoughts and sentiments about private equity, the industry, or about Bain Capital, of course, which was co-founded by Mitt Romney. You can also join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page. And I want to get Colin Bladen back to respond to some of what Eileen Applebaum was saying quite critically, but also giving us a sense of, well, equity about private equity. And Colin Bladen, you wanted to make some clarification points?
Yes, I did. This can be a very confusing discussion. So I think it's very important to step back and ask ourselves, what does private equity do? Where do they get their money? For whom do they do it? And what are the results? First, what do they do? They invest in companies. They try and make those investments more valuable. They get their money to do that by raising funds from private investors, many of whom are large public employee pension funds that fund the pensions of firemen, teachers, policemen. Ask yourself the question, if I'm going to improve a company, perhaps particularly one that might be struggling or not performing particularly well, to make it more valuable, what will I try and do? I will try and make it more efficient. I will try and make it more productive. What will be the outcome? It will be more valuable for the people who are managing the investments, and those are the private equity funds that we and the private equity managers we've been talking about, but they also will be the pension funds that we're all concerned about because they are so underfunded right now. And these private equity investments are among their best hope for helping to pay those pensions in the future. If you're improving a company, including the ones that Professor Applebaum spoke approvingly of, like the steel companies, if you're trying to improve them, all of those steel worker wonderful jobs that existed 20, 25 years ago in the new transformed steel companies that are competitive, that Ms. Applebaum speaks approvingly of, those same old jobs aren't there. They aren't there in the same number. They aren't there with the same benefits. They aren't there with the same pay. The same could be true of our automobile industry, which has been transformed to be much more competitive. But when that got changed, it got changed in a way that didn't always preserve all of those United Auto Worker wonderful jobs and their benefits. And that was done without private equity. As a matter of fact, it's a transformation that President Obama and the government has been bragging about that they did.
And which Mitt Romney said he would not have stepped into bailout.
That is true. But I think it is important, Michael, that we step back and we say, what do these things do? What do these investments do? What are they trying to do? And then what are the results? We should not be surprised that some of the companies that are invested in, if it's a growth story, will add jobs and expand. Others, like the steel companies and the auto companies that get transformed to be more competitive, may have a very different story about employment. But as a country, do we want to have a competitive auto industry, a competitive steel industry? The answer is yes. And who are the people who can often do that best? It is these private equity investments.
Which also brings to the fore the question that we framed this morning's discussion with, and that is the the politicization of private equity in terms of the presidential campaign, I ought to mention that Governor Romney's record was put up to a question in a Washington Post poll. 21% said that it mattered to them in terms of their voting. 21% said it didn't matter, and 54% said it would have no effect on their vote. That's just sort of interest. But a lot of the criticism comes down to, I suppose, that profits are made, big profits in management and fees and dividends and the tax breaks and so forth. Robert Reich calls the magic of private equity a giant con game and says it has to be stopped. End the carried interest loophole that allows private equity managers like Romney to treat their income as capital gains. Hold the managers of private equity funds, hedge funds, and pension funds to a due diligence standard. So if the funds lose money and these managers didn't exercise due diligence, the Pension Guarantee Corporation can claw back their bonuses. And, of course, he mentions resurrecting Glass-Steagall and raising the capital gains rate to match the tax rate on ordinary income, especially for short-term investments. Give a tax preference only to patient capital, that is, for investments held for, say, 5 years or more. And some of your emails are coming in here. Drew writes, American private capital should be interested in growing America. That would include growing employment. However, as pointed out by your guests, at best, private equity does not kill or maintains employment levels. If so, what justifies their special tax treatment? The right continually fights higher taxation on job creators like those employed in private equity, yet they are creating no jobs. And another listener, Mike, writes, I suggest we take away the tax and other subsidies given to private equity, such as the deductibility of corporate debt, carried interest, and the dumping of pensions on the government, and then see how private equity does. Eileen Applebaum, some of this resonate for you?
If I could just say one thing about the prior conversation on the jobs issue. I think the people who defend private equity to that extent like to focus on the distressed investing. Can I just make the point again that no more than about 2% of private equity investment goes into distressed investing? The rest of it is buying healthy companies. So you can't explain the fact that they destroy jobs in retail, that they destroy jobs when they take over publicly traded companies, and that they fall behind in general. The study that showed that they fall behind had several hundred thousand establishments in it. We're not talking about some little study. They did a great study. They spun their results. That's another story, but they did a great study, and it really showed that private equity does not do well in the job area.
All right, I want to bring our callers into this. I should also mention right. That a number of listeners are emailing. They're saying, in effect, as I understand it, the president, here's Drew from Hayward, who says, is not attacking private equity as much as Mitt Romney's claim that managing Bain qualifies him to be president. How does that match up? Or Frank in San Rafael, who says, framing the argument as an attack on private equity is a straw man. The issue is whether a background in private equity, i.e. Bain Capital, is a qualifier for the office of president. Let's go to your calls, and we'll begin with John. John, join us.
Hello.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
So I'm actually on the senior management team of a company here in the Bay Area that was privately owned by a founder and a group of investors and then was sold to a private equity firm and then eventually was bundled with another company and then sold again to a new private equity firm and now, of course, is for sale again to probably a larger private equity firm or perhaps a very large corporation. So in my experience, private equity really, the key understanding is that private equity exists as a mechanism for creating great wealth for the investors in the private equity group. And there can be a side effect of creating a better or stronger company or in some cases saving a company from its sort of self-destructive spiral that companies can sometimes enter into. And there's a big difference between sort of venture capital and startup scenario and the private equity business, which is really in the business of purchasing companies and trying to find a way to turn a profit on them.
What you've just defined, I think, pretty much squares Colin Bladen, doesn't it, with what you've been saying?
It does. I would simply ask our caller one question. One of the arguments as to why the private equity model is superior to the public equity model is one, more focused attention by the people who are the owners, but also because of strong incentives given to a management team for them to perform. So if, in fact, the company becomes more valuable, yes, the private equity investors indeed benefit. But the strong incentives given to a management team such as yours should make wealthy men also if that management team performs. And the third group that makes money when that really succeeds, as I said, are the public employee pension funds who get 80% of the capital gains putting up the money to do the deal in the first place.
Let me thank John for his call. And,
can I comment on that?
Please do, Eileen Applebaum. Yeah.
Well, let's just talk about the incentive structure for the top executives in the companies that are bought. A, they are handed a debt structure by the private equity firm. They had no say about it. The managers in general, the top ones, have to put up some of their own wealth, but they're promised great riches if they can meet shareholder targets, and they are fired if they fail to deliver quickly. So what we know from academic studies is that 39% of CEOs are replaced in the first 100 days after private equity buys them, and 69% in a four-year period. I don't know what you can do in 100 days to improve efficiency and productivity. You certainly can cut costs aggressively. You can lay off workers. You can reduce benefits if there's no union. You can speed up. You can intensify. There are a lot of things that you can do in 100 days. None of them have anything to do with making the company more effective. So the incentive structure that's given to those top managers really is perverse, in my opinion. I think that's a major problem. And this idea that private equity sells from one private equity company to another, this is a big thing. It's always happened, but it has never happened as much as it is happening now. And one of the reasons is private equity is private. Everybody can make money by selling a company that you can't take public from a private equity company to a private equity company. You have private equity companies with money that they can't find a place to invest, and you have private equity companies with what they call mature investments. Private equity likes to buy and sell within a 3 to 5 year period. If you're holding them at 6 or 7 years or 8 years and haven't sold them, you're in big trouble because those funds only last 10 years. And then you have to liquidate and you might be taking losses. So the company with the mature investments needs to get rid of it. The company with the money that it can't find where to spend needs to spend it. They make everybody happy by selling from one to the other. But, you know, this is a game of musical chairs, and the music is going to stop at some point. If we talk about the returns to the pension funds, as opposed to the returns to the private equity companies, two-thirds of the money that private equity companies make, they make on their management fees, not on the profit that they get from selling. But if you're talking about the pension funds, they get their money, of course. They pay those management fees, and they only get money if the fund makes a profit.
Yeah, Colin Bladen wanted a response.
Yeah, Ms. Applebaum, I just want to differ emphatically about your 100-day comment. There are a lot of things that get done in that 100 days. The smart owners and new managers can transform the strategy. They can redirect the efforts of the company. They can commit to major capital investments that put a company onto a new path. And a lot of the evidence out there is that if you move quickly and emphatically to do that, that is where you get the best improvement. And it's not just distressed companies.
All right, we've got Leon on the air here. I wanted to go to this next caller because he wanted to bring up something about VC investors. Leon, go ahead.
Hi, I just had a comment for Professor Applebaum. You know, VC, venture capital as part of private equity, doesn't seem to fit any of the criticisms that she's laid out. There's no leverage in those particular situations. These venture capitalists invest only in innovation and the creation of jobs, as far as I can tell. And I guess I'd be concerned that any policies put in place to regulate private equity broadly creates collateral damage on the venture capital side where it would be unwarranted, where you'd be destroying value from investors who are only interested in creating it.
Eileen Applebaum.
I agree with that comment completely. I distinguish between venture capital, in which, in fact, people do put up their own money. It's all equity. You don't have a cash flow that you can, burden with debt. So I think venture capital is one thing, private equity is another. And I myself have not talked about regulation. I've talked about limiting the deductibility of interest, which would not affect venture capital at all. And I do think that carried interest, as opposed to return, carried interest is not a return on investment. It's a performance bonus, and it should be taxed as any other performance
bonus. Actually, according to Reuters, there could be a tax site legislation by the end of this year.
I would be in favor of that. But venture capital actually invests, and that is an investment, and it would get the capital gains treatment.
All right, we'll bring in another caller here. Russ, thanks for waiting. Join us on Forum. You're on.
Hi, I'm a business writer. I've covered business for about 30 years, including 10 years at Business Week. And I've written about private equity. I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal on this performance bonus tax issue. I think the guest from the private equity side, like a lot of people in the industry, is being purposely misleading when they liken this fee to the capital gain on someone's house. It's much more like a bonus for the real estate agent on the house. There is no capital gain. This is a fee. It's like the income I get for doing my job, and 99% of the people get for doing their job if they meet certain performance benchmarks, and has nothing to do with capital gains. And I wish the industry would stop misleading people this way.
Comment from you, Colin Bladen.
Well, the capital gains is pervasive in our economy. It applies to a lot of investments. And because private equity is in the crosshairs right now, it's getting a lot of attention right there. But there are capital gains in real estate. There are capital gains in the energy field. There are capital gains for public companies, not just these private equity companies. So the tax treatment that is available to companies that are private is the same tax treatment that's available for companies that are public. And we should be asking our public company managers to do the same thing the private company managers are trying to do. That is improve the competitiveness of their enterprises and make them more valuable.
Here's a listener, Jim, from Fort Collins, Colorado, who writes, in the middle of the 20th century, Louis O. Kelso developed the notion of the employee stock ownership plan, ESOP. One of the primary utilizations of ESOP was to continue family-owned firms by giving the employees an option to buy out the retiring owners. After all, the employees had the greatest interest in continuity of the business. The evolution of private equity a decade later, especially as exemplified in the leveraged buyout, undercut the prospects of employee buyouts by favoring private capital firms over employee acquisition. Another listener raises the question, are all private equity firms the same? Do some have a greedy reputation while others are white knights? If so, how does Mitt Romney's company rate on the greed scale? I don't know if either of you want to comment on that. Is Bain pretty much sort of in the mainstream of private equity firms, Eileen Applebaum, or does it have more of an avaricious reputation?
I don't think there's been any research done on that. Perhaps your other speaker can.
What do you think?
It's very interesting. Bain has been a mixture of both venture capital and leverage buyout. Its earliest investments were primarily venture capital investments, and later, as they got to be bigger, they expanded into larger deals and did put leverage on them and bought existing companies and began to do more leverage buyout. But Bain, over its history, has done both.
Well, Bain also has a record that really, in some respects, I mean, you look at some of the big names that they've been involved in, Staples and Sports Authority and companies like that.
That was venture capital investment.
But it was venture capital, exactly my point, yeah.
Well, it was venture at one point, and then as the company began to grow, it became something you would probably characterize as today's hot button, which is called growth equity. And both venture firms, particularly the big ones and the buyout firms, that is the big thing they're doing. They're often making minority investments for capital to help companies grow. Some of them are mature companies. It's pretty venturesome to be doing it, but it's still a buyout type investment. And venture capital funds are doing the same. So the distinction between the two in one of the biggest areas, namely growth equity, is beginning to blur between buyout and venture.
And here's a listener who writes on our website, and you can put your comments on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. Many publicly traded companies over time become poorly managed and overstaffed. We have seen it with old companies like Chrysler, as well as newer tech companies like HP and Cisco. Private equities do the tough job of cleaning up those companies. I wonder if it's better to force those companies through bankruptcy rather than allow private equity to intervene. And we'll go to more of your calls. We'll bring David on. David, join us.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. I wish the gentleman from the UK had not gone away, because I wanted to ask him why he was picking on President Obama for talking about private equity companies that did not perform in the most charitable manner. New York Times has written about it. A book has been written about it. And it was Rick Perry, the Republican, who coined the term vulture capitalist. So, you know, and then my second sort of point is at what point is it okay to talk about, you know, the evil deeds of these companies? I mean, do we not talk about, I hate to use this as an example, but do we not talk about priests abusing children because it's only been a few? I mean, there's been enough abuse where I think it's appropriate to talk about what's happening with the abuses of private equity. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call. Well, Eileen Applebaum, you seem to take an even-handed attitude that private equity is
sure.
doing some good and bad things, but what about listeners highlighting?
So there are many ways that private equity makes money, and the one that we've been talking about is making companies better, and I agree that they do that. But there are other ways. There's transfers from workers to the private equity owners, which happen when they lay off workers and intensify work for those that remain, when they shift work from union to non-union facilities when they own both of those. There's a transfer from the portfolio, the company they actually buy, to the private equity owners through dividend recapitalizations. We haven't talked about those, but those are controversial even among people who are supportive of private equity. And this is when the private equity owners can't wait till they sell the company to make their gains, but in fact they either take it out of the company's cash flow or they load the company up with additional debt in order to pay themselves a dividend. And frequently that dividend is as large or larger than the money they put up in the beginning. And that was true of Bain Capital when it took over HCA, the largest for-profit chain of hospitals in the country. They loaded the company up with the hospital chain up with debt, and then they paid themselves a dividend by selling junk bonds and paid themselves back. And then when they went public, they made money again. Sometimes these companies are driven into bankruptcy. Mervyn's, they took a dividend recap. That's why Levi Strauss is suing them now, because they said, you knew when you took that dividend recap that it was going to drive this company into bankruptcy and we were not going to get paid, and you did it anyway, and that's not legal. We have Sun Capital, which did the same thing with Friendly's, and they've gone through bankruptcy. Harry and David, we have a lot of examples.
But aren't the darker side of this, the caller brings up just the result often of profit being made by firing workers or cutting wages and benefits or both?
Well, that's the transfer from workers to private equity companies. We have transfers from the companies they acquire. We have transfers from taxpayers. The leverage that they put on alters the debt structure so that these companies now pay less in taxes and the rest of us have to pay more. And they use tax arbitrage. Sometimes when they make those acquisitions, they do them strategically in order to reduce taxes, because you can put the profit on the company in the low-tax country or the low-tax state in the U.S., and then it doesn't get taxed. You have ways of moving this stuff around.
We need tax reform above all. I think that's what you're
saying. It would help. It would definitely help.
Would you agree, Cotton Blaine?
But I would say that what I said earlier, the taxes apply even-handedly to companies that are privately owned and to companies that are publicly owned.
Absolutely.
If public managers are improving the value of their company and they're doing some of the things and all the kinds of things that Professor Applebaum is talking about, is she more approving of it because it's a publicly owned company and critical of it if it's a privately owned company where the gains might go to public employee pensioners?
Can we just talk about that for a second? We want to be even-handed and clear about what we're talking about.
Yeah. I want to hear what you have to say about pension funds.
The New York Times, you know, I mean, I could tell you the academic research, which basically shows that on average you do as well in the S&P 500. But let's just take a look at something that's easier to understand. The New York Times just took a look at all of the public pension funds, and it looked at the 10 public pension funds with the highest share of these kinds of investments. The range from 34 to 56% of pension assets in these things. Median five-year return, 4.1%, which is about what you can get with the S&P. And the range of the five-year returns is from the lowest, got 2.5%, the highest, 6.2%. Then they looked at the 10 public pension funds with the lowest share of alternative investments. And the range of investment shares and alternatives, a lot of them had zero, and the biggest one had 10%. The median five-year return is 5.3%, not 4.1%. The worst performing had a return of 4.4%, which beats the median five-year return for the ones with lots of investments in these kinds of things. and at the top 7.6%. So the pension funds with the lowest share of alternative investments over the last 5 years far outperformed the pension funds with the highest share of alternative investments. It's just not true that if you can invest with the very top private equity companies, you can do better than the market. But for everybody else, they are doing worse than if they had invested in the S&P 500.
Final word on this from you, Colin Bladen?
No, that is correct. You have to invest in the good managers to make the good returns. That is something that is very well known in this industry. And it's also true in other areas of investments. It's not just private equity.
Maybe we can get one more call in. Mike from Nicasio, let's hear from you.
Yes, it's not a rumor, but many, many commentators have mentioned that the investment banks that are used as advisors for leveraged buyouts of public companies undervalue, because they want more business of private equity, they undervalue the shares that are being converted so that the public company shareholders are also cheated in many instances. The other question is, what administration put these tax reforms in, these tax regs in, that greatly benefit the private equity industry?
I would say, first of all, the taxes apply evenly to private equity and to publicly owned companies. Nobody created tax benefits, especially for private equity. That is just plain
wrong. That
goes
way back, actually.
Yeah. And the other one you mentioned, which is sort of management buyouts, where a management tries to lowball the price at which they're selling to private equity so they can go and participate in it, has largely been taken care of.
All right. We're out of time, alas. I want to thank you, Colin Bladen, for being with us from the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, and Elaine Applebaum, senior economist with the Center for Economic Policy and Research. Also, thanks to Sebastian Malaby, who joined us earlier from the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks to you, our listeners, and thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell and Katrina Schwartz. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.